facility. I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but I might just point out a couple things. We don't have a regular text. One of the problems is we never know how many people are going to sign up for the course. It's difficult to order books and make sure that they arrive on time. So all of the books that are listed in the readings are available here at the library. And we've put them on reserve since a number of people will be wanting to read the same book. You can't check it out, but you can stay here and read as long as you want to. And our library is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so any time of the day or night that you feel like coming over and reading any of these books, please feel free to.
It's really the main door online.
Yeah. Yeah, you can come in here and call our furniture off.
I think I tried that one time.
In fact, we've had that happen before. Okay, also, the readings are not as extensive as they could be. As you'll see, the books I've put on reserve cover not only the readings here, but a lot of other books, too. But I was getting exhausted, and I thought you would get exhausted trying to look through all the possible readings. But if you have a particular interest, please feel free to come to me, and I can perhaps recommend additional reading if you're interested in a particular archaeological period or biblical topic, whatever. Especially for those of you who don't have much background in biblical studies, there are two books that I would recommend. They're both listed in some of the recommended readings, and that is first the book by H.T. Frank called Discovering the Biblical World. It's not terribly profound, but it is a good introduction into biblical studies, biblical world in the context of the ancient Near East. And the other book is by Bernie Anderson, something like Understanding the Old Testament. The edition we have here is the third edition, which is the most recent one, but the first or second edition is fine too if you happen to own those. And finally, I would suggest that as you're reading, especially when we get into the third lecture and the fourth and so on, when we start dealing specifically with archaeology and the relationship to biblical studies, at that point I would suggest you use the Oxford Bible Atlas, and if possible, I would imagine that the Baptist bookstore and perhaps some of the other bookstores in town do have this atlas. It's very helpful with a number of different maps of ancient Palestine during the patriarchal period, during the period of the united and divided kingdoms, during New Testament times, along with brief, very easy to read and understand commentary. So that's very helpful. Two versions of the Bible that I would also strongly recommend is one, the Oxford Annotated Bible, which is a good study Bible. It has a lot of very helpful footnotes and cross-references in it, as well as the Apocrypha, which a number of English translations of the Bible don't contain. It says Oxford Annotated Bible. It's actually an RSV, Revised Standard Version translation. And the other one that's very helpful or very useful is the Jerusalem Bible. Again, those are not requirements, but just suggestions.
What's the difference between the Jerusalem Bible and that?
Again, they are different translations. Originally, the Jerusalem Bible was translated into French and then translated into English. Most people would say that the Jerusalem Bible is one of the smoothest translations, capturing some of the feeling and emotion, especially in sections of the Old Testament like Psalms and Proverbs, which are in poetry. One thing that you may not realize reading an English translation of the Bible is that almost all of the Old Testament is written in poetic form, Hebrew poetic form, and that is usually indicated in the Jerusalem Bible by the way in which they set up the paragraphs and so forth. very little of it is prose, whereas when you read most translations into English, not only does it read like prose, but the paragraphs are set up like prose. So you get a little bit more of that feeling of poetry through the Jerusalem Bible, and especially the footnotes. You'd say the footnotes are a little more detailed, a little more critical in terms of modern critical biblical studies than the Oxford Annotated Bible is. Basically, the Oxford Annotated, or RSV, is a revised version of the Old King James Version. Dartmouth. I'm not really that familiar with the Dartmouth. Again, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, if you want a different view, and sometimes it can be interesting, it's always kind of fun to look at the old Scofield Bible, too. I have a lot of problems myself with the Scofield Bible, but that's certainly a different approach to things. Okay, I think that's really all we need to say. I should say that, as you can see, the first two lectures are introductory in nature, geared primarily for those of you who don't have any background at all in archaeology. And I apologize for those of you who have taken courses before, and a lot of this will be reviewed before we get into the actual biblical themes in the third and fourth lectures. And we'll be going chronologically from prehistory then to the Early Bronze, the Middle Bronze, Late Bronze, Iron Age, Hellenistic Roman, right up to the Roman period in the time of Christ. And that's where we'll stop. Not that the other periods aren't significant, but since we are concentrating on archaeology and biblical studies, that seemed to be an appropriate place to cut it off. Again, I'd like to reemphasize for those of you who weren't here last time that one of the hesitations I had about offering this course is knowing that we're going to have people here representing all kinds of different backgrounds, especially all different kinds of religious or theological backgrounds. I will not try to stir up controversy, but I don't think there's any way that I can avoid controversy. And in fact, I often feel that when you're talking about biblical studies, that it is good to present a wide range of views during the lectures, even though you may reject them out of hand. I hope that people don't get offended, and it'll probably be more interesting if you are willing to state your point of view, and we can bat ideas back and forth without hopefully offending anybody. Okay, first of all, if you look at the syllabus, you can see that what I wanted to try to cover tonight is a brief history of Palestinian archaeology, the controversy surrounding biblical versus Palestinian archaeology, and discuss a little bit of what the background of that is, and try to define the goals of both biblical and Palestinian archaeology. Give a brief explanation of excavation and survey techniques, and a few words about modern advances. And then again, we'll try to keep some time at the very end to discuss when we'll be meeting on Monday, Wednesday, or Monday, Tuesday. You'll often hear the terms biblical archaeology and Palestinian archaeology used interchangeably. That was certainly the case up until 10 years ago or so, but now, more and more, there is a distinction being made between biblical archaeology and Palestinian archaeology. Different people would define those distinctions differently, but at least it seems to me that you can say the characteristics of biblical archaeology are threefold. One, that biblical archaeology is geared towards enhancing our understanding of the Bible excavations. It's the first aim of biblical archaeology. One of the second goals or aims is to identify biblical sites. That's taken up a lot of the energy of the biblical archaeologists trying to find out if the modern Arab village of Beitin is in fact Bethel, that's referred to in the Old Testament, or if the modern village of Tabakat Fahal is in identifying biblical sites, and third, trying to clarify biblical chronology. And although I mentioned that third, that has been one of the primary goals of the biblical archaeologists up until now. 100 years ago, people had very little idea when Abraham lived, what the absolute dates for the life of Abraham were, or what the absolute dates for the life of David and Solomon were, or the prophets and so forth. It's interesting, as you read the Old Testament, it may slip your mind, but if you look carefully at the Exodus account, for example, you'll find that Pharaoh is named, but there's no mention of which Pharaoh it was. And so that's been one of the concerns of biblical archaeologists, trying to establish which Pharaoh the Israelites escaped Egypt under. And of course, by identifying that Pharaoh, then you come to an absolute date of when the Exodus took place. So if those are the goals of biblical archaeology, you can define Palestinian archaeology as the archaeology of this area, which does not restrict itself to the so-called biblical period. We'll be dealing with this later, but we can roughly identify the biblical period as from 2000 BC to about 100 AD. And we'll go through a review of the history of archaeology in this part of the world. And it's clear that the early archaeologists, almost all, were biblical archaeologists, and they were concentrating on this period, from 2000 BC up until the time of Christ. And in fact, that legacy is still with us today, in the fact that we know a lot more about, say, the Middle Bronze Age, around 2000 BC, or the Late Bronze Age, than we do about much later periods, the Ottoman period, for example, which just ended with the First World War, is very little understood in archaeological terms. And of course, because of this emphasis of biblical archaeology on the biblical period, such things as the prehistory of Jordan and Palestine were neglected until very recent times. So Palestinian archaeology deals not exclusively with the biblical period and is not primarily interested in answering questions about biblical history. Palestinian archaeology, of course, has to deal with biblical history, since that is a segment of the archaeological record here, but it is much more all-encompassing. One of the reasons that people these days do not want to be identified as biblical archaeologists, and in fact, before being here, I was in Montana teaching a course. Before I arrived in Montana, I told them I would give a course on in biblical studies and also archaeological studies, and they had already set up the title of the course in biblical archaeology. And that upset me a little bit, because whenever you say you're a biblical archaeologist, one of the things that happens is that you're identified with biblical archaeologists of the past, and there were a lot of abuses. One of the worst abuses was the total neglect of the earlier periods and the later periods. As we'll be talking about in a minute, ancient cities grow into tells or mounds, which means, of course, that the later material is on top and the earlier material is on the bottom. A practice of early biblical archaeologists, and some still occurs at times, is since they're interested in the biblical period, they'll get on there with a bulldozer or just a big mob of men and just excavate right through the top of the tell to get down to the Iron Age or the Late Bronze Age, so the biblical periods that they consider to be very significant. So there's been a lot of damage done to sites because biblical archaeologists were so concerned about this one very brief period. Also, biblical archaeologists have the reputation of being very biased, of having their minds already made up as to what they want to find, which is not a very good way to go about scientific exploration. I have just a couple examples here. this is something that we'll be doing throughout the course also, pointing you towards reading material, journals and books dealing with biblical archaeology and criticizing it to a certain extent. This is one little publication called Bible and Spade, which if you're very conservative, you might like it, but it's about the most conservative publication on biblical archaeology that you can find. And just to give you a kind of a typical attitude that you find often expressed in this journal, this is the very end of an article which is discussing the identification of a site, an ancient site in Palestine, which has been thought to be De Beer, and maybe there's another site that's De Beer. And this particular editor thinks that they've come to a final decision, and he says, Kirbat Rabut therefore satisfies all the conditions for the identification with biblical De Beer. Once again, scholars have had to change their opinion in light of additional evidence which has shown the biblical record to be correct in every detail. That's really the function of this particular journal, is to demonstrate that archaeology is proving that the Bible is historically accurate in every case. And that's a question we'll begin with throughout the course. This is another article. They have results from news from Jordan, results of the 1979 excavation of Sodom and Gomorrah. There are several articles like that. Those, of course, are a reference to the excavations of Bab Adra and Numerah. But they can be a little bit misleading, giving you the impression that the archaeologist is coming to much more definitive conclusions than in fact we really are. Okay. Just to give you a brief history of biblical archaeology and its development in this part of the world. And to mention one other publication, the Biblical Archaeology Review, which is very similar to Bible and Spade, comes from a very conservative viewpoint. Surprisingly, the editor is a liberal Jew in New York, but most of the articles are quite conservative along the lines that archaeology is proving the accuracy of the Bible. We don't have the most current issues, and I hate to recommend this, but they do have about 2 issues ago a nice little article on Sir Flinders Petrie, who was one of the earliest, most important, in a sense, fathers of the archaeology of Palestine. So if you have this publication or know where you can get a hold of it, you might want to at least look up the article on Sir Flinders Petrie. The problem with this particular journal is that it's more or less the Ann Landers or gossip column of biblical archaeologists. They stirred up a lot of controversy over the Ebla text and tenuous identifications. And there, in fact, are a number of archaeologists who would like to sue the fellow who edits this journal. The problem is that he's a very clever lawyer, so nobody wants to take him on. It's difficult to say whether archaeology is a very young science or a very old science. In some senses, it's very old. Going back to ancient times, we have clear evidence that from the earliest times, kings and wealthy people went to great pains to bury themselves in monumental mausoleums or caves, and concrete evidence that those tombs were often robbed out. So in a sense, you could say that the earliest archaeologists were the ancient tomb robbers. There's hardly a cemetery in this part of the world or an ancient site that has not been disturbed, at least to a certain extent, by either ancient or modern tomb robbers. The reason I would put ancient tomb robbers in the same category of archaeologists is because as archaeology began to develop in the 19th and 20th century, you'll find that a lot of the early archaeologists were little more than tomb robbers or treasure hunters. Certainly, the attention of Western explorers and adventurers was drawn first to places like Greece, Egypt, Mesopotamia, where you had monumental architecture like the pyramids that could be explored and possibly looted at times. Because Palestine does not have a lot of monumental architecture, it was always a backwater in ancient times, and attention was not attracted to Palestine until later. That's something to keep in mind as we go throughout this course. Coming as most of us do from a Judeo-Christian tradition, we have a tendency to think of Palestine as being very important in ancient times. And certainly, from our perspective, religiously, historically, what happened here in Palestine certainly had a great impact on Western civilization. On the other hand, we should also remember that Palestine never achieved the greatness that was Egypt or Mesopotamia. It was always important strategically because it was on the main trade routes between the great empires located in the north, in Mesopotamia and Asia Minor, and in Egypt. But never developed greatness. Perhaps you could say at one point in the Iron Age under David and Solomon for about a 50-year period, power, political power, and economic power was concentrated in Palestine, but it was a very short-lived period. And from that point on, at least compared to other great nations in ancient times, Palestine was never that important. That's probably then why the early explorers neglected this part of the world. But around 1805, you do find the beginnings of Western explorers coming to Palestine, and almost invariably, those people were biblical scholars. They were not archaeologists by training, or architects, or surveyors. Almost always, they were biblical scholars. Just a few names. One of the earliest explorers was a German by the name of Zetzen. He was here around, 1805 and 06. It's very difficult to get copies of his accounts, but if you ever find one in an old bookstore, be sure to snatch it up because they're very, very valuable. Zetzen is credited with being the first Westerner to discover, or at least report to the Western world, the site of Jerash and a number of other sites in the region. He also explored around the Dead Sea area, and in fact, at the end of his last exploration in 1806, he went up to Jerusalem and proceeded to die from malaria or some other disease that he got in the Dead Sea and a district that some of his accounts of, especially the villages of Karak and Mazar, are very, very interesting indeed. Burckhardt, came through the area in 1812, and you may know of his accounts of visiting Petra. He's, again, one of the first Westerners to have gone in to Petra. I try to avoid saying that these people discovered Petra or discovered Jerash, because of course Petra and Jerash were never lost. The people here knew about them the whole time. But they were the first people that brought it to the attention of the Western world. Another couple of explorers that came by were Irby and Mengels in 1818. They're credited with discovering the site of Arak El Amir. Again, very interesting accounts of their explorations, but also very rare. They published only one little booklet that was privately distributed in London, and I've never actually been able to get a copy of it, but you do read references to that. Well, we could make a big list. One of the most important early Americans to explore this particular region was Edward Robinson. He came several times, but most of the work was in 1834, I believe it was, right around that period. Another American came through in 1849, Lynch. He was an Army navigator, a naval officer. And he did a lot of explorations right around the Dead Sea area. So if you're particularly interested in that region of Jordan, they make some fascinating reading. Another fellow was De Saucy, French fellow. He came in 1851 and continued to work both here and especially in Jerusalem through the 1860s. One of the important things about De Saucy is he is the first one that we can say is a modern, well, not modern, but he's one of the first excavators. All of these other people, especially Robinson, were interested in going around the country and trying to make identifications of modern villages with ancient biblical sites, and usually they were doing it by linguistics. They weren't picking up pottery, they weren't excavating. They were looking carefully and studying the derivation of the modern Arabic names for villages, and on that basis making the identifications with the ancient biblical names. In fact, Robinson was the fellow who pointed out that Tabak et Fahal in the Jordan Valley was probably ancient Pella.
Is he right?
We think he's right, or at least we're still calling Tabak et Fahal Pella. That's in, I would have to say, in the one thing that these scholars have over a lot of archaeologists and ancient Near Eastern scholars today, I think they did know their languages much better than we do. Especially their Arabic, ancient Hebrew, Aramaic, Latin, Greek. And when it came to linguistics, they were certainly as good as we are today, I think. Another, well, yeah, De Saucy excavated in 1851 the area in Jerusalem known as the Tomb of the Kings. And that's why I'd say he is the first excavator, although he hardly qualifies as an archaeological excavator in the modern sense. Basically, what he did was went in and cleared the whole thing out. It's been a massive operation. We're very lucky that De Saucy lived in the pre-bulldozer age, or we probably wouldn't have any sites left in Palestine. Just to give you an idea of what William Albright, who is one of the more famous American archaeologists in the 20th century, what his opinion of De Saucy was, he says that in 1863, 51 and 63, De Saucy explored and excavated in various places. Since his enterprise exceeded his knowledge and his vanity exceeded both, there is little to show for his work. And I think a criticism like that could be applied to most of the early explorers, perhaps Robinson being an exception to the rule. He did do some very careful work. Another important name in the history of early biblical archaeology is Charles Warren. He was here in 1865, or went to Jerusalem in 1865, and that is a very important landmark. That marks the establishment of the Palestine Exploration Fund, which the British set up for the archaeological exploration of Palestine, and of course, biblical studies were closely tied in with their agenda. 5 years after that, the American Palestine Exploration Fund, or Exploration Organization, was set up in 1870. And if you read some of the documents relating to the American Palestine Exploration Organization, you'll find that their primary goal was to illuminate and to defend the biblical record. That, again, is fairly characteristic of the early biblical archaeologists. It was not their intent only to clarify the biblical record, clarify biblical history and chronology, but also to demonstrate that the Bible was accurate against its critics and detractors. Again, it's very important to realize during this time, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, there was quite a debate raging between especially the German Old Testament scholars and the American Old Testament scholars. One very important name among the Germans was a fellow by the name of Julius Wellhausen, who was primarily a literary critic, not an archaeologist at all, but he called into question a lot of the biblical text in terms of its historical accuracy. And so, very clearly, there was an American reaction led by Old Testament scholars who had an interest in archaeology and felt that by excavating, they could demonstrate that the biblical text was a reliable source, not only of theological or spiritual truth, but also historical information. And that certainly gave a lot of stimulation, a lot of motivation for the early archaeologists. Warren, although he's the first person who came and started systematically excavating in Jerusalem, he still operated with very crude techniques. And he is one of the first of the so-called tunnelers. And he's been criticized greatly for that. Say if you have an ancient tell, Warren's approach, realizing that the good things are probably right in the center rather than on the top, he would, rather than opening up a large area, either tunnel down to it or tunnel in from the side. But when you go about things like that, it's very hard, as we'll see as we go along, to keep your material straight. So as far as helping to clarify the chronology of ancient Jerusalem, where he was primarily working, he really didn't accomplish too much. In his defense, you'd have to say that it's not hard to understand. Even today, when an archaeologist goes out in the countryside, very often you raise suspicions because people don't understand exactly what you're doing. Why are you being... At least the accounts indicate that one of the reasons that he tunneled down beside walls was to get out of sight as quickly as possible and not to arouse suspicion among the locals. Probably the most important early figure in so-called biblical archaeology is a fellow by the name of Sir Flanders Petrie. Put a date roughly of 1890. He started out in Egypt, like a lot of the early archaeologists did, in the 1880s, and then came up to Palestine around 1890. Again, his primary concern was biblical chronology. With the work he had done in Egypt, he felt that he would be able to excavate at a Palestinian site, use his knowledge of Egyptian archaeology, and especially the Palestinian pottery that he had found in Egyptian context, which were well dated, and that he would be able to date the Exodus. That was one of the big things in the early days, to date the Exodus and to date the conquest, the time that Joshua entered Palestine with the Israelites. As I mentioned, this Biblical Archaeology Review about a year ago had a fairly decent article on Flanders Petrie. You might say that Petrie, although he was a genius, I think he was a little bit over-impressed with his own genius. When he died, he had willed his head to the, the London Institute for Science or something like that. And for a long time, evidently, they had a difficult time getting his head back to London, or at least I've heard that for several years, Nelson Glick, when he was head of the Albright Institute in Jerusalem, our sister organization, that he had Sir Flinders Petrie's head in a big jar of formaldehyde in the basement. I think they finally did get it back.
He used to take measurements. He thought he was smarter than everybody. His brain was going.
Is that right?
Yeah,
he was a strange fellow. But he was also a very good archaeologist. When he came up to Palestine, he made a number of observations, two of which I think are the most important things to remember or of his contribution. One, he pointed out that, which is obvious if you've been here walking around at all on the ancient sites, is that in Palestine, ancient cities were very, very small, often not more than one or two city blocks. He still would refer to an ancient city. There's a debate going on among some of us here at ACOR as to whether you can talk about the ancient sites here in Jordan as cities. I think they are cities. They're small cities, but whether you call them cities or towns or villages or settlements, whatever. So he drew attention to how small the cities were, but more importantly, he pointed out how the cities were built. That is, how the mounds came into being. And at this point, I'd like you to look at this little handout, which has the heading Hypothetical Tells. In a sense, it's misleading to say that Petrie was the one who demonstrated how tells were formed and how they ought to be excavated, because Schliemann in the 1870s had noticed that at Troy, but it was Petrie who first drew the connection that the same thing was applicable here in Palestine. The top section you see shows a tell as Petrie saw it, or as he described it. To mention the fact that tell is the Arabic name for a mound. Archaeologists use this as an indication that a tell is an artificial mound. That is, that it's an accumulation of debris caused by human settlement or occupation. In fact, and some of those of you who know Arabic much better than I can tell me, but I believe that in Arabic a tell means any mound. It might be natural.
No, it means made by men.
It does have to be man-made.
The same way that
sure about that.
So,
doesn't it mean just a hill?
Just a hill.
No.
And mountain is a
hill. No mountain, I know, but there is a natural hill and a hill made by man, like these archaeological tells. They have two names.
Okay, there's a little debate. I have always understood that a hill was a natural, in any case. The way we refer to it, or will be referring to it, is an artificial mountain. If you read IEJ or some of the Israeli publications, they'll also refer to a tell with one L. In Turkish, it's known as a tepi or huyuk. I think that's the right spelling, Al? So, okay, this, according to Petrie's explanation, you would have maybe a small natural hillock. Somebody would come along and build a city on top of it. That city, after a while, would, made of mud brick, would collapse. Debris would spread out. The city would be rebuilt, and you'd get another layer and another layer, and so forth, until you have this big mound building up. He felt then that if that's the way it was, the youngest material ought to be on the top, and the oldest material should be on the bottom. Therefore, he started digging sequentially, and I wouldn't use the word stratigraphically. His idea was the lower you dug, if you strip this off, then strip this off and go down, the lower you get, the older material you're going to be finding. And that's true, almost. The problem with the way he dug and the way he saw the formation of a tell was that he felt that no matter what, the lower you went, the older the material would be. And so he dug in 50 centimeter arbitrary levels. And again, what underlines that assumption is that this accumulation of debris is going to occur at a regular rate. In fact, what we find in ancient tells is much more complicated, and it's illustrated by this second drawing. First of all you have to do is walk outside and you realize that the surface of the ground we walk on is very seldom totally flat. You have bumps and holes and so forth. Also, whenever you find, as you often do find on an ancient site, a pit that's dug in, you might find a very late pit that goes down very deep. And so you could imagine, looking at this little drawing here, if a person just went across 50 centimeter levels all the way down, that your pottery would be hopelessly mixed up, because you would always be encountering this pit, which is the latest level, and mixing the pottery and all the other findings from that pit in with the other layers, so your pottery gets hopelessly mixed up. So, Petrie does represent an advance over the old tunnel diggers or tunnelers, and is known as a sequence digger. A fellow by the name of William Albright, who showed up after World War I, is certainly one of the most important biblical archaeologists of the 20th century. And he, along with Kathleen Kenyon, did a lot to refine the techniques which Petrie had started. And what Albright, actually in his early days, he wasn't too good at this, but he got better and his students got better at it later, emphasizing that as you dig, you have to dig not sequentially, not by arbitrary layers, but following the stratigraphy or the soil layers, which may be very uneven. And only by doing that can you be certain that the materials that you're getting will be getting older and older the lower down you go. Other important names in biblical archaeology, especially for this part of the country, are Nelson Glick, who did an amazing job of archaeological surveying in the 1930s. Also, a fellow by the name of G. Ernest Wright, who worked at Shechem. Actually, the Shechem excavation, you can look at the staff on the Shechem excavation and see that almost every major so-called biblical archaeologist was either trained or their professor was trained at Shechem under G. Ernest Wright. What's interesting about all of these people, or almost all of them that we've mentioned, Wright, Albright, going back to the early explorers, they're almost all biblical scholars. And most of their archaeological training was in the field, on the spot, rather than in academic classrooms. That is changing now, but still, I think you'll find that most of the people who are working in the biblical periods or are concentrating on the biblical periods are primarily theologians or Old Testament professors rather than professional archaeologists. There's one very practical reason for this, and that is there's not much of a market for professional archaeologists. It's very difficult to make your living doing that, so you'll find that even the people who are working in prehistory or in the later periods generally are professors in universities that are teaching other subjects, maybe archaeology among them, but other subjects as well, linguistics or art history, anthropology. They come over in the summertime and do their excavation, then go back to their universities. So I don't think it's exaggerating to say that to a great extent, archaeology, biblical archaeology, and Palestinian archaeology in general has been a hobby for most archaeologists rather than their primary means of support. Okay, are there any questions about any of that?
Characteristic of Petrie you didn't mention. You said there are two special.
Okay,
as
well,
it is pottery sequence, maybe you want to, you said two that are.
Again, well, yeah, just his recognition of how
yes.
tells were formed
yes.
and how small they were.
Yes.
Those are the two things that I was thinking of.
Certainly,
he also did recognize that pottery changes The lower you get, the style of the pottery changes, the bases are different, the handles are different, and so forth. The problem is that Petrie was always more interested in objects than he was in pottery.
No, but so the sequence that he, the middle one is older than the
He did pick out a few absolute dates, things like the old Abydos jars, which were found in well-dated Egyptian tombs. For example, if you find a jar that right in here, and you know the absolute date of that jar, like an Abydos EB2 jar, say you know it dates to 2800 BC, then you can tell, at least relatively, everything above that is going to be younger, and everything below it is going to be older. And then I think, is that what you mean, Adriana?
No, and also that the center one, in a cemetery especially, you find a sequence, relative sequence. In a cemetery, the center part is the oldest, while the lateral one, he found the sequence. I mean, he couldn't find the absolute dates, but he found the sequence.
Right. And a lot of these people weren't going, rather than absolute dates, going sequentially. But again, although that's a contribution on the one hand, the fact that he didn't recognize how complex stratigraphy can be, you know, that sequence was often out of sync. Okay, we're just about out of time. Let me say just a few words, though, about archaeological survey. Obviously, from the term, an archaeological excavation involves digging at a site, but more and more archaeological surveying is becoming important. If you've been out on an ancient site, you know that all you have to do is walk over the surface of the tell, and you can find flints, pottery, artifacts of different kinds. And very often you can date the period of occupation by those objects. Now, obviously, most of the things that you're going to find on the surface of a site are going to be the latest, represent the latest occupation of the site. But, nevertheless, especially if you find an erosional cut or a cut made by a bulldozer and so forth, you can very often find pottery which represents all periods during which the site was occupied. This is tremendously important for a number of reasons. One of the most important reasons for doing an archaeological survey is to identify the periods of occupation, which then tells you whether or not you want to dig on that particular site. Especially if you're a biblical archaeologist and you are interested in the biblical periods, it's better to do a survey, find a site which has primarily Iron Age Middle Bronze through Iron Age pottery, rather than to find a site that has a lot of Islamic pottery on the top, which you're going to have to remove in order to get down to the Iron Age levels. In fact, there's a good example of how a survey paid off like this. The Tel Hayat excavation that's taking place right now in the Jordan Valley was chosen, not because it is a big site, but in fact because the surface survey indicated that there was early bronze and middle bronze pottery on the site. Whereas most sites in Jordan, certainly Bab al-Draa and Iskand are two of the most important early Bronze Age sites, show that occupation ends very abruptly at the end of EB4, around 2100 BC. Tel Hayat is one of the few places that occupation continues through the early Bronze 4 period, right into the middle Bronze 1 and 2, and so that was the reason for choosing that particular site.
Where is Hayat?
It's down in the Jordan Valley, very near Pella. Just a little bit to the west.
About north of Bab al-Draa.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bab al-Draa is way at the southern end of the
Sea. I don't mean Bab al-Draa, I mean Deer Alley. Deer
Alley, yeah. It's about 25 kilometers north.
Right or left?
On the left, to the west. Another important thing, contribution, archaeological survey has to make, is that when you're on a site, especially a large site, by doing a careful archaeological survey, you can often identify different areas of specialization on the site. For instance, if you go, you find an Iron Age site, you can identify its Iron Age by the pottery. A careful survey might indicate where areas of slag are concentrated, that part of the city, smelting operations were taking place. In other parts, you might find a concentration of figurines or cult objects. It indicates that a temple may well be in that, on that part of the site, and so forth. Domestic pottery indicates that you're in the residential section of the city. And I would mention, too, I think it's very important at this point to say that more and more emphasis is putting on being put on archaeological survey now, because, first of all, it's much cheaper to do. Secondly, so much development is going on in Jordan. We have to survey the sites, identify where they are, what date they are, before they're destroyed by bulldozers, building roads and building buildings. And one of our problems now, not only is development taking place very rapidly and destroying sites, but again, more and more of us are getting interested in archaeology and going out and picking up sherd collections. So it's getting more and more difficult to tell what periods are represented at an archaeological site through surface survey, because so many people are collecting the pottery. Well, we've run out of time. Let me take just a minute to ask you for a vote on when you want to meet. I think we're settled for Mondays, so we'll vote on whether you want to have the meetings, the second meeting on Tuesday or Wednesday. And before we take the vote, is there any debate or any points that anybody wants to make? Okay, well, maybe I missed something. Is that what other people understood?
Yes, I understood.
Monday and Tuesday, will it change that? Tentatively,
right. I have had a couple people tell me that Monday and Wednesday would be much better for them. Again, as far as I'm concerned, I'm quite willing to go either way.
But there was a couple of people who not come.
Right. Again, I think that's the same thing. There's some that cannot come on Monday and Wednesday, and some that can't on Monday and Tuesday. What if we just do a vote then? Who will stick with Monday, and then ask who wants to have the second class on Tuesday? Okay. What about on Wednesday? Okay, I think we better go with Monday and Tuesday then. That seems to be the best time. All right? Okay, we've got cookies and coffee in the back. Linda's got a list back here. If you want to pay, pay her and she'll sign you up, and then we'll give you a receipt next time you come to class. Yeah, and our next class then will be next Monday.
I am one of these, but I was told that I couldn't come today.